Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. On June 6, 2025, I met up with Andrew Curran at the Bio Conference in D.C. to talk about his biographical work. While some of our conversation focused on his 2019 biography, Diderot and the Art of Thinking Freely, published by Other Press in 2019, I had the honor of reading a very early draft of his forthcoming group biography, also from Other Press. Biography of a Dangerous Idea, a new history of race from Louis XIV to Thomas Jefferson, explores the development of the concept of race during the 18th century and how figures like Louis XVIII and Thomas Jefferson, among others, contributed to the construction of racial ideologies that continue to influence society. Andrew Curran, you've co-written a book with Henry Louis Gates called Who's Black and Why? And you have a forthcoming book called Good Beyond Belief that you're co-writing with Dennis Rasmussen. And I wonder what it's like to collaborate with somebody on biography.
Well, I've done three different kinds of collaboration. I should probably start here. The first one was working with somebody who was translating one of my books, a different book, into French. And that was a particularly intense kind of experience because we're looking at language and we're kind of trying to figuring out the best way that I could express what I wanted to say in French working with this translator. The second big collaboration I did was with Skip Gates on this project called Who's Black and Why? And this is kind of a funny book. It's an archive-driven book. It is about a contest that took place in 1739 in the Bordeaux Academy of Sciences. And the Bordeaux Academy of Sciences sent out this call for papers in 1739 asking for the best solution to the problem of blackness, where blackness came from. And Skip Gates called this the Dead Sea Scrolls of Race, which is interesting because it was like a vertical slice of time in 1739 that kind of talked about where race came from, where these different explanations came from. Theological explanations, material explanations, naturalistic explanations, explanations that blame the mother, which is always the case as well. So anyway, we worked a lot on this. And the first thing we needed to do was look at each essay and contextualize what was going on in each essay, whether the person was a theologian or a naturalist, kind of a natural historian. And then ultimately, once we had this all done, we came up with a big introduction, which we ultimately published in the New York Review of Books and was translated elsewhere as well. And I have to say it was a fabulous experience because we were able to look at this moment in time and really kind of contextualize it, resuscitate the kind of characters who were in it, figure out what was going on in Bordeaux in 1739. Bordeaux, as it turns out, turned out to be a pretty big slave trading capital in Europe. And we also played ping pong with the ideas, sometimes agreeing, sometimes disagreeing about what we wanted to say. As you might imagine, I learned a ton from him. He is such a huge force of nature. He works very hard, and we had a terrific collaboration. We did a lot of touring together as well. And you also asked about the second project, which is a new project, Good Beyond Belief. This will be my second group biography. I'm finishing up a book called, I'm actually publishing a book right now called The Race Makers. Good Beyond Belief is my second crack at group biography, and this one is written with Dennis Rasmussen, who is a very, very accomplished biographer. I have to say we haven't done too much work on it because I just handed in my manuscript, but what I can say is that he's written about half of it already, and I'm going to be writing the second half, and the split is more geographical than kind of intellectual, which is to say he works much more on the Scottish Enlightenment, rather the English Enlightenment, and I'm working on the French Enlightenment.
Interesting. I wanted to talk a little bit then about this book, The Race Makers. It's a group biography spanning the lives of 13 individuals, leaders, if you will, from King Louis the 16th all the way to Thomas Jefferson. What made you choose that time frame?
Well, I think one of the funny things about the history of race, and this is my third book on the history of race, is that most people don't know where it came from. Which is to say that if we were to interview 100 academics or 100 people on the street, probably 5 out of 100 would know where race came from. The idea was invented during the 18th century. I should say quickly that xenophobia and various forms of what we would now call genocide have, of course, happened in the past. The transatlantic slave trade, the trans-Saharan slave trade were also operating way in the past. But the idea of race as a biological notion really came into being during the 18th century. And I wanted to tell the story in a way that was accessible to a lot of people. My two previous books were, I would say that the book I did with Skip Gates is, I would call, vertical history. It's a slice in time which allows us to see what people were thinking in 1739 to 1741. And the other book I did was a much more kind of horizontal history, intellectual history, moving from about the 16th century all the way to the 19th century, where we're following the idea, putting a tracer on it. And still in all, people I realized that even if these books are successful, I needed a way to trick people into, I wanted to find a way to trick people into reading much more about the history of race. And biography, I think, is the best way of doing that. I call this intellectual history bait and switch, which is to say you're being lured in by Louis XIV, you're being lured in by Thomas Jefferson, you're being lured in by Voltaire, David Hume, and Adam Smith. And what you do find out is that there's this really interesting genealogy that takes place during the 18th century, and you get to see the complexity of the people and the ideas as they take shape. Each person represents, I would say, an intellectual history tendency, whether it's anatomy, or the first naturalistic proto-evolutionary explanations of race. And so as you move through to Thomas Jefferson, who embodies all the contradictions of both the European and American Enlightenment, you have a good idea of where race came from.
Yeah, and one of my favorite things about that book in the end is that you talk about Thomas Jefferson and his controversies with Sally Hemings. And one of the ideas that you brought forth was this idea that his writings have survived him, or his writing is his legacy in a sense, and he knew that. And so during his life, he was a very controversial figure. He still remains a controversial figure. But I want to talk a little bit about how his writing was so revolutionary. And you know, you bring up this idea of the I Have a Dream speech is, you know, kind of embedded in there, yes? Right?
Yeah, I think that Thomas Jefferson has a dual legacy. And the problem with reducing him to one thing is that we just don't understand what Joseph Ellis calls the American Sphinx side of Thomas Jefferson. He is very hard to understand. But he embodies the dual legacies of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment era is the era that produced all of the values that we kind of cherish, theoretically, in the United States. We call that the tradition of Enlightenment humanism and liberalism, freedom of thought, freedom of the press, so on and so forth, freedom of religion. These ideas came out of the Enlightenment era. At the same time, the Enlightenment is often accused of rationalizing human existence, the dehumanization of various people through new forms of knowledge. And Thomas Jefferson, who was really America's first kind of great and important race maker, was deeply, deeply involved in this process. Very, very quickly, it's interesting to note that he was terrified and really angry about the way that Europeans were talking about the people living in North America and the Americas in general. Buffon and some of the other European thinkers accused North Americans of being degenerates, literally physical and moral degenerates. The white Creoles, the white people who are here, he claimed were less intelligent, were unable to think in the same way as Europeans. The Amerindians were stilted, stunted, unable to kind of move beyond first kind of levels of existence. And the final group was the Africans, or the transplanted, or the enslaved Africans who were taken to the United States. all three categories, according to numerous Europeans, were degenerate. They had suffered degeneration from an original prototype, and they were lesser forms of humanity, lesser either races or varieties. Thomas Jefferson defended the Amerindians. He was one of the great defenders of the Amerindians, and also the whites. But in order to prove that people had not changed over time, he essentially threw blacks under the bus by saying you can see that these people were inferior from essentially from birth, or their race in general was inferior. And that's one of the things that has made him so controversial and has gotten him canceled. These are his writings in the Notes on the State of Virginia.
Yeah. You're also a professor at Wesleyan, and your students, when you talk about race, today's kids or students today talk about race as a social construct. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how DNA testing kind of muddles all of this. What influence has DNA testing had on the on concepts of race and identity?
Yeah, I think DNA really cuts both ways. It's so interesting, very much like, how to put this? DNA both emphasizes our common humanity. 99.5 or 99.9% of all humans share the same DNA. There is no such thing as polygenesis, the idea that there were separate types of humans at the origin of humankind. Humans are very, very closely related, and complexion is really a mask that fools us all. I mean, pigmentation is really insignificant. And so DNA certainly proves that. So DNA really refutes the idea of some essential categories into which each kind of person can be put. It's impossible. There's a palette of colors and possibilities, and very often DNA analysis allows us to see that people within a certain, two people within a given race a person within a given race might have more in common with someone from a different race than that person would have with somebody in his or her own race. So DNA really is one of the great universalist type ideas. At the same time, people now are still reifying race by looking at DNA like, oh, I am, 75%, Swedish, I'm 25% this, that, and the other thing. So they're associating geography with biology. And that's one of the dangerous things which was done by the Germans, to talk about nation and people as one thing. So DNA analysis is doing some of the similar work that old racism did too.
I'm so curious. I mean, I would love to go down that even further, but later. So you've written all these books, right? The Race Makers, Diderot. I want to talk about Diderot for a sec. No, but before I do, you've written all of these, you've written books on race and atheism, and I wanted to know, that's not how I want to ask this question. Simply put, what qualifies as an Andrew Curran biography?
Well, I can talk about the fact that I aspire to be like Diderot, even though I'm, 1% as smart as he was. He was an amazing polymath, and I would say he's...
I just want to interrupt and say that you wrote an incredible book in 2019 on Diderot, so go ahead.
Right, so Diderot was my first biography, and very, very quickly, I wasn't expecting to write a biography about Diderot. I'd written a book about him earlier, a kind of traditional academic book. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote an article for the New York Times about him, and I was asked by a couple presses to write a biography. So I became a biographer kind of overnight, and I loved it. And I think that whatever I write, I do try to be like Diderot, which is to say I'm a radical empiricist. I don't know where I'm going. I didn't know where I was going in The Race Makers. I didn't know who the characters were going to be in The Race Makers. I've dumped tons of people into a big compost heap. I did the same thing with Diderot. So to answer your question, what constitutes my kind of biography? I just go out there blind, trying to find stuff, and then piece together a narrative. I certainly want to make sure that I've realized that people are looking for a reason not to read the next sentence that you write. So I'm really trying to make these things interesting, whether I'm writing about race or Diderot. So the Diderot biography is a single person biography. It's quite different from the two group biographies I've been working on. I think that the Race Makers would have been impossible for me to write if I hadn't written the Diderot book. The Race Makers it brings together so many different sides of the way I think about the world. First, there's a significant history of medicine side, which I'm very interested in. There is an intellectual history side to that book, which talks about the fact that the era itself determines the shape that ideas take over time. And I also think that the Race Makers allows people, it allowed me to understand who the people were within the institutions within which they functioned, their relationships with people, and sometimes some of the most bizarre reasons, the bizarre kind of contingencies pushed people to think about race in the way that hadn't happened before, which is to say that some weird anecdote would push somebody to writing about race, and that person wouldn't have done that. Thomas Jefferson, for example, was asked to fill out essentially a questionnaire about Virginia. And as he's writing this whole thing, all of a sudden, oh, guess what? I'm going to publish this book on Notes on the State of Virginia. And that's where he develops his race ideas. And these are the kind of things that come out in a biography, a biographical history of race.
Fascinating. Wow. I wanted to talk a little bit about your upcoming book, Good Beyond Belief, because we're kind of talking about process. And you still have not written your half of that book, as you say. And I wanted to know, it's called Good Beyond Belief, and it's a history on atheism. What makes you so interested in atheism as a topic, and where do you begin with something like that?
Well, maybe I could start with an anecdote about my own life. I had a hard time believing in God. I was always a skeptic from when I was a little kid. I remember being 4 years old, lying in bed, thinking that there was nothing out there in the middle of the night, listening to AM radio. It was a kind of a funny thing. And so later on, I was fascinated by the fact that there was an enormous group of people who had kind of thought this way and had gotten into trouble for doing so. And Diderot was the most interesting example of that, because he's not a straight-ahead, dogmatic, monological type atheist. He's a dynamic thinker. Somebody talked about his atheism as being enchanted, which seems to be a contradiction in terms, because he was trying to find the beauty of godlessness. So I was fascinated almost as an intellectual and aesthetic kind of idea as well. Dennis is also fascinated by this, and he came up with this idea. Again, the book's called Good Beyond Belief. Probably be out in 2 or 3 years. And the idea is identifying the group of people who were the first people in the history of humankind and in kind of general European history to think that you could be an atheist and be good. Because for the longest time, people who were seen as atheistic or not believing in God were immediately understood as being evil or sometimes put to death even. So there's a trajectory that starts in the 17th century with Pierre Bayle, B-A-Y-L-E, and moves all the way through the Scots and the English and to the French, and that's where I come in to talk about Diderot yet again, and another guy named D'Holbach. And ultimately, the Marquis de Sade is in this story too, because he pushes the idea of natural morality to its extreme. In other words, if morality comes from revealed sources like the Bible, you're going to think of it in one way. If morality comes from civic society or our bodies, then that'll be seen in an entirely different way. So secular morality is a hugely important concept in the 18th century, and we're living it today, right? That tension between revealed religion and morality and secular morality, civic morality, morality determined by government and humans, is something entirely different. And this is a book that brings that to light, I think.
Yes. Yes and yes. I wish we could go down that rabbit hole, but we are here to talk about biography. So I wanted to go into Diderot for a second. You said that you came across Diderot by accident, or you wrote his biography by accident. And since we're at a biography conference, and you wrote biography by accident, it's safe to say that maybe there's somebody else in the future that you would be interested in writing about. And I'm curious, since you wrote this group biography called The Race Makers, and there are 13 people in there, who is one of your standout characters in that book that you'd like to explore a little deeper? I'm really curious.
Wow. What an interesting question. There's a guy in that book named François Bernier, who was a world traveler. He was the first person to come up with a scientific classification of race in 1684, the year before the Code Noir was put forward by Louis XIV and Colbert. And he was his life was astonishing. He goes to Egypt and catches the plague and almost dies there. And he goes off to India and hangs out with the Emperor of India for 10 years and travels all over the place. His stories and his understanding of the world at that time were really revolutionary. And he had, had a very secular view of the world, too, which is to say that at that time, most people were very religious. And he was the, had been tutored by a guy named, by the name of Gassendi, who was a secular thinker, even though he was a priest. And he made Bernier look at the world from a very naturalistic, proto-scientific point of view. So he's very interesting. I'm also find this guy named Jean-Baptiste Labat, L-A-B-A-T, also to be fascinating. He's a Dominican priest who runs a slave plantation in Martinique and also writes this amazing, amazing travelogue about his experiences in Martinique. So I get to spend a lot of time in Martinique when I think about him. So that's great.
So writing a biography is a really great way to travel the world.
If you do, especially group yes. biography. You know, for this book, I went to, you know, Sweden, I went all over France, I went to Martinique. I mean, I went a lot of different places to think about. I think place is super important. The biographies that don't have a lot of the feeling of place and geography, I am less interested in. I mean, intellectual history biographies that are well done, you know, I can plug into that and love that as well. But I think the combination of thinking about the way people lived is so critical. I learned more about the 18th century writing the Diderot biography than I had ever learned before, because I just was thinking what it was like to be in prison. Diderot was in prison. What you ate in prison, what it was like to travel, what travel schedules were like. I mean, I just looked up everything and I just came so much closer to, I think, to what it was like to be alive in the 18th century rather than just looking at what was going on in intellectual history.
So as a professor and as a writer, a biographer, you probably do a lot of sitting, right? You have a job where you do a lot of, you know, sedentary work. What do you do for self-care? How do you take care of your body?
I teach Tai Chi.
You do?
I do. I'm a Tai Chi professor.
Wait.
Yeah, so.
Wait, you're a Tai Chi professor?
I teach Tai Chi, yeah.
You do?
I do.
Tell me more. What's that about?
Well, I came back from France in 2000 and to a small town, and my wife also came back, and we were kind of like, what are we doing here in some ways? And we wanted to kind of break free from, as nice as university is, kind of, you know, just hanging out with professors all the time. She went and is a black belt in karate, you know, and I started doing Tai Chi. I had a stomach operation, so I couldn't do karate. That was, the doctor told me, don't get kicked in the stomach. So I did Tai Chi, and that's been fantastic. So after about 8 years of hard study, I worked harder on that than I did in most of my books. My teacher said, go off and teach. So, and I've been doing that ever since. And I do Western and Eastern because I go for a run. I went for a run this morning, and I also do Tai Chi and things like that as well.
I'm so glad I asked. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much too. This is great.
That was Andrew Curran talking with me about his forthcoming book, Biography of a Dangerous Idea: A New History of Race from Louis XIV to Thomas Jefferson. It will be published on February 10th, 2026 by Other Press. This interview was recorded at the Bio Conference in Washington, D.C. on June 6th, 2025. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellie and Marie Fillinganes created our podcast theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer, Sherry Newman is our engineer, and Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.